This is a Moraine Valley Community College Library event podcast. For more information, visit www.morainevalley.edu/library.
Hello, welcome everybody. Welcome to a program of interpretive readings here at Moraine Valley, sponsored by the Counseling Department, as well as the COM 107 class of Cheryl Bundy. Here at the library. What we're going to be doing today is you'll be hearing a number of literary works from throughout the 1900s, even the 1800s, and they are works which have something to do with mental illness. And Cheryl's class will be reading those works for us. Prior to doing that, however, we are going to hear a short work by a student here at Moraine Valley, somebody who has experienced mental illness and who has written a short work about it, and I'll be reading that for you now. Once, I used to be a dark and heavy cloud, forced to oblige with the earth, not caring what it made me do or how low my clouds brought me. I became heavy and full of precipitation. No matter how much rain I released, I was always in a constant storm. Electricity pulsed through my veins and emitted hot, scorching charges that glared so brightly the sight of them burned your retina. It was as though a camera had been flashed so closely to your face that you were blinded by everything except for the ever-consistent white glares. Constantly carrying the rain made me heavy and forced me to be low to the ground. My desire to be light and feel the heat released from the sun drove my obsession to lift myself from the cold, damp earth. I needed to lift myself above the ground. I needed to become one with the wind, constantly moving in one direction, forward. I needed to touch the shimmering golden rays that expanded out from the sun. The rays were arms that reached out to the breathing organisms of the earth, holding the gift of life in its palm. I became obsessed. I needed to release the heavy precipitation that accumulated inside of me. So I created storms in order to release the weight of the rain. I stormed to release the overbearing load of droplets inside of me. The intense downpours flooded my surroundings until cars appeared to be floating on a man-built ocean atop the worn-down asphalt. The precipitation inside of me began to regenerate so ferociously that I couldn't keep up with the multiplying amounts of water. No matter how many thunderstorms I created, I couldn't lift myself up. Not even an inch. And then I stopped trying. And then I became angry. And those storms became stronger and stronger and stronger. Once, I used to be a hurricane, destroying everything in my path. My path was happiness, and my mission was to hit it with 80 mile per hour winds and flood the environment and leave nothing surviving. The sun tried to reach its long arms out to the earth in order to stop the destruction. Its palms opened up wide and tried to grasp onto the innocent life that was being completely liquidated below, but it was no use. My hurricane was malevolent and seemed to be driven by Lucifer himself. My relationships, education, hopes, and dreams of the future maliciously swirled around the circumference of the cyclone. My tears led the path of the storm. The small base of the cyclone randomly zigged and zagged, bouncing left and right, mimicking the way my tears would trickle down my face. The wailing sounds of my cries were the only noise that the tempest produced. The intensity of the sobbing masked the screams that up until this point had never been released. Sirens rang and dispersed their high-pitched echoes in order to warn those around that they needed to get out of the way of the storm. But the pitch radiating from the intercoms were completely disguised by the overlapping wails from within. Once I was a dark and heavy cloud whose burden was the inability to shed the ever-reproducing amount of rain inside my giant fog of color. Now I am wispy, heavy no more. Finally able to seek shelter within the sun. Once I was severely depressed, hid from my illness and hid from the world. Now I am cured and will show the earth and everyone on it that I will hide no more. Only after disaster can we be resurrected.
Hi, everyone. I'm Cheryl Bundy. I'm here with my COM 107 creative writing fiction students. The goal of today's reading is to share excerpts from a variety of literary works. Some are by writers who lived or are still living with mental illness. Some are by writers exploring mental illness in some way. And I think our purpose is to show some of the ways written art has tried to capture, explore, or explain behavior. Often that art has tried to raise awareness about illness, about treatment. Our purpose is also to thoughtfully consider the ways certain depictions of illness can perpetuate notions that are harmful and that can stigmatize. I think any exploration of mental illness in literature is necessarily complicated. The texts are situated within their own time, within that period's understanding of psychology and behavior. The texts are also situated in their own author's understanding of those things. I think our exploration is also complicated by us. We bring our own experiences to a text. We compare, and we might inadvertently dismiss a text that could offer insight, even if it doesn't match what we think is correct or accurate in the portrayal. We're also products of our society, and our society is one that perpetuates certain notions about mental illness and about artists. So in short, it's complicated. The context we provide today won't be complete, but it's a starting point. The first text I want to just mention, at least at the start of this, before we get into some of the wonderful readings we have planned for you today, is just a quote. It's from a pretty famous book written in 1774. It's a book by Goethe. It's a German text. And the quote reads, "Is this the destiny of man? Is he only happy before he acquires his reason or after he has lost it?" The quote comes from a book called The Sorrows of Young Werther. And it's a book that Goethe wrote when he was just 24. It was the first novel he wrote. And this is kind of the dawn of the Romantic movement. It's one of the reasons why the text is so important. But the book is notable because it was intensely popular. It was the catcher of the rye of its day. It was popular with young readers in particular. In the story, the narrator commits suicide due to unrequited love. The book was so popular, in a way, there was almost merchandising around it because people would wear clothing similar to what the narrator wears in the story. But it's also notable because there were several suicides that happened after the book came out, like copycat events. In fact, it's very common today for journalists to talk about something they call the Werther effect, and it's one reason they cite for not maybe wanting to talk about suicides that happen in our culture. They might not want to report on it in depth because there's a fear of a similar kind of copycat approach happening. The downside to that is that it sort of suggests the idea that it's not okay to talk about these things. And it does create or contribute to the kind of stigma that we're talking about. So I think it's just an important text to at least start with today. The first text we're going to read from is one that probably everybody in this room has read before for a high school literature class or maybe here at Moraine. It's by Edgar Allan Poe, and it's The Telltale Heart. It was written in 1842. It's another example of a romantic writer, an American writer this time, not German. And the story is told from the perspective of a person who is mentally ill and possibly schizophrenic. In the excerpt you're going to hear, the narrator of the story speaks to us about how carefully he proceeded to kill another man and conceal the crime. Unfortunately, it's also a good example of a common stereotype around mental illness that's presented in the media and culture, and that is that mental illness and violent behavior go hand in hand. The excerpt is going to be read by Kylie Betger, and we're going to hear from Pam first about the mental illness that's depicted there.
So the character, the main character in The Telltale Heart may be suffering from schizophrenia. People suffering with schizophrenia may experience visual or auditory hallucinations. They may speak or act in incoherent or irrational ways, and they may exhibit catatonic or paranoid behavior. The hallucinations or delusions can be terrifying, which can cause people with schizophrenia to become withdrawn or agitated. These people will likely experience social or occupational impairment. People with schizophrenia are not usually violent, but as many as 10% of people with schizophrenia will die by suicide. A 2009 study reported that 1.2% of Americans, 3.2 million, were suffering from schizophrenia.
It is impossible to say how first the idea entered my brain, but once conceived, it haunted me, day and night. Object? There was none. Passion? There was none. I loved the old man. He had never wronged me. He had never given me insult. For his gold, I had no desire. I think it was his eye. Yes, it was this. He had the eye of a vulture, a pale blue eye with a film over it. Whenever it fell upon me, my blood ran cold. And so, by degrees, very gradually, I made up my mind to take the life of the old man, and thus rid myself of the eye forever. Now this is the point. You fancy me mad. Madmen know nothing. But you should have seen me. You should have seen how wisely I proceeded, with what caution, with what foresight, with what dissimulation I went to work. I was never kinder to the old man than during the week, a whole week before I killed him. And every night, about midnight, I turned the latch of his door and opened it, oh so gently. And then, when I had made an opening sufficient for my head, I put in a dark lantern, all closed, closed, that no light shone out. And then I thrust in my head. Oh, you would have laughed to see how cunningly I thrust it in. I moved it slowly, very, very slowly, so that I might not disturb the old man's sleep. It took me an hour to place my whole head within the opening so far that I could see him as he lay upon his bed. Ha! Would a madman have been so wise as this? And then, when my head was well in the room, I undid the lantern cautiously, oh, so cautiously. Cautiously, for the hinges creaked. I undid it just so much that a single thin ray fell upon the eye of the vulture. And this I did for 7 long nights, every night just at midnight. But I found the eye was always closed, and so it was impossible to do the work, for it was not the old man who vexed me, but his evil eye. And every morning, when the day broke, I went boldly into the chamber and spoke courageously to him, calling him by name in a hearty tone and inquiring how he had passed the night. So, you see, he would have been a very profound old man indeed to suspect that every night, just at 12, I looked upon him while he slept. Upon the 8th night, I was more than usually cautious in opening the door. A watch's minute hand moved more quickly than did mine. Never before that night had I felt the extent of my own powers, of my sagacity. I could scarcely contain my feelings of triumph, to think that there I was, opening the door, little by little, and he not even to dream of my secret deeds or thoughts. I fairly chuckled at the idea, and perhaps he heard me, for he moved on the bed suddenly as if startled. Now you may think that I drew back, but no. His room was as black as pitch with the thick darkness, for the shutters were close fastened through fear of robbers. And so I knew that he could not see the opening of the door, and I kept pushing it on, steadily, steadily. I had my head in and was about to open the lantern when my thumb slipped upon the tin fastening, and the old man sprang up in bed crying out, "Who's there?" I kept quiet, still, and said nothing. For a whole hour, I did not move a muscle, and in the meantime, I did not hear him lie down. He was still sitting up in bed listening, just as I have done night after night, hearkening to the death watches in the wall. Presently, I heard a slight groan, and I knew it was a groan of mortal terror. It was not a groan of pain or of grief. Oh, no. It was the low, stifled sound that arises from the bottom of the soul when overcharged with awe. I knew the sound well. Many a night, just at midnight, when all the world slept, it has welled up from my own bosom, deepening, with its dreadful echo, the terrors that distracted me. I say I knew it well. I knew what the old man felt, and pitied him, although I chuckled at heart. I knew that he had been lying awake ever since the first slight noise, when he had turned in the bed. His fears had been ever since growing upon him. He had been trying to fancy them causeless, but could not. He had been saying to himself, "It is nothing but the wind in the chimney. It is only a mouse crossing the floor." Or, "It is merely a cricket which has made a single chirp." Yes, he had been trying to comfort himself with these suppositions, but he had found all in vain. All in vain, because death, in approaching him, had stalked with his black shadow before him and enveloped the victim. And it was the mournful influence of the unperceived shadow that caused him to feel, although he never saw nor heard, to feel the presence of my head within the room. When I had waited a long time, very patiently, without hearing him lie down, I resolved to open a little, a very, very little crevice in the lantern. So I opened it. You cannot imagine how stealthily, stealthily, until at length a simple dim ray, the thread of the spider, shot from out the crevice and fell upon the vulture eye. It was open, wide, wide open, and I grew furious as I gazed upon it. I saw it with perfect distinctness, all a dull blue with a hideous veil over it that chilled the very marrow in my bones, but I could see nothing else of the old man's face or person, for I directed the ray as if by instinct, precisely upon the damned spot. And have I not told you that what you mistake for madness is but over-acuteness of the sense? Now, I say, there came to my ears a low, dull, quick sound, such as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I knew that sound too well, too. It was the beating of the old man's heart. It increased my fury as the beating of a drum stimulates the soldier into courage. But even yet, I refrained and kept still. I scarcely breathed. I held the lantern motionless. I tried how steadily I could maintain the ray upon the eye. Meantime, the hellish tattoo of the heart increased. It grew quicker and quicker and louder every instant. The old man's terror must have been extreme. It grew louder, I say, louder every moment. Do you mark me well? I have told you that I am nervous. So I am. And now, at the dead hour of the night, amid the dreadful silence of that old house, so strange a noise as this excited me to uncontrollable terror. Yet, for some minutes longer, I refrained and stood still. But the beating grew louder, louder. I thought the heart must burst. And now a new anxiety seized me. The sound would be heard by a neighbor. The old man's hour had come. With a loud yell, I threw open the lantern and leaped into the room. He shrieked once, once only. In an instant, I dragged him to the floor and pulled the heavy bed over him. I then smiled gaily to find the deed so far done. But for many minutes, the heart beat on with a muffled sound. This, however, did not vex me. It would not be heard through the wall. At length, it ceased. The old man was dead. I removed the bed and examined the corpse. Yes, he was stone, stone dead. I placed my hand upon the heart and held it there many minutes. There was no pulsation. He was stone dead. His eye would trouble me no more.
The very well-known story by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, The Yellow Wallpaper, provides interesting insight into the medical profession and treatment of mental illness at the time. The story is about a woman whose husband is a doctor. Not knowing how to treat her postpartum depression, he falls back on old treatments that had never really been shown to benefit patients, in this case, the so-called rest cure, which was popular at the time. It involved severely limiting stimuli and activity. Gilman, a journalist, wrote a story that captured her personal experience with illness and such a treatment, partly to raise awareness. Of the story, she said, quote, "It was not intended to drive people crazy, but to save people from being driven crazy, and it worked. In this excerpt, we'll follow the narrator near the end of the story, once her illness has progressed to the point of psychosis, as she obsesses over the wallpaper that adorns the room in which she's stuck. The excerpt will be read by Tanya Torres.
The character in this story was likely suffering from postpartum depression. Major depressive disorder is reported by the National Mental Health Institute that an estimated 16 million adults suffered from this in the year 2012. Depression is characterized by persistent sadness, although in children, adolescents, and males, irritability may be more evident. Other symptoms include a loss of interest in normal activities, weight loss or weight gain, lack of sleeping or excessive sleeping, loss of energy, feelings of worthlessness or guilt, difficulty concentrating, indecisiveness, and recurring thoughts of death or suicide. In some cases, depression can be accompanied with a brief psychotic episode or psychotic features. Psychosis is the occurrence of delusions, hallucinations, incoherent speech, paranoid or catatonic behavior. A brief psychotic episode will last at least one day, but less than one month, with eventual return to pre-psychotic functioning. These episodes may occur in conjunction with disorders such as depression, including postpartum depression.
So now she is gone, and the servants are gone, and the things are gone, and there is nothing left but the great bedstead nailed down, with the canvas mattress we found on it. We shall sleep downstairs tonight and take the boat home tomorrow. I quite enjoy the room, now it is bare again. How those children did tear about here. This bedstead is fairly gnawed. I must get to work. I have locked the door and thrown the key down and into the front path. I don't want to go out, and I don't want to have anybody come in till John comes. I want to astonish him. I've got a rope up here that even Jenny did not find. If that woman does get out and tries to get away, I can tie her. But I forgot I could not reach far without anything to stand on. This bed will not move. I tried to lift and push it until I was lame, and then I got so angry I bit off a little piece at one corner, but it hurt my teeth. Then I peeled off all the paper I could reach standing on the floor. It sticks horribly, and the pattern just enjoys it. All those strangled head and bulbous eyes and waddling fungus growths just shriek with derision. I am getting angry enough to do something desperate. To jump out the window would be admirable exercise, but the bars are too strong even to try. Besides, I wouldn't do it. Of course not. I know well enough that a step like that is improper and might be misconstrued. I don't like to look out of the windows, even. There are so many of those creeping women, and they creep so fast. I wonder if they all come out of the wallpaper as I did. But I am securely fastened now by my well-hidden rope. You don't get me out in the road there. I suppose I shall have to get back behind the pattern when it comes night, and that is hard. It is so pleasant to be out in this great room and creep around as I please. I don't want to go outside. I won't, even if Jenny asks me to. For outside, you have to creep on the ground, and everything is green instead of yellow. But here I can creep smoothly on the floor, and my shoulder just fits in that long smooch around the wall, so I cannot lose my way. Why, there's John at the door. It's no use, young man, you can't open it. How he does call and pound. Now he's crying for an axe. It would be a shame to break down that beautiful door. John, dear, said I in the gentlest voice, the key is down by the front steps, under a plantain leaf. That silenced him for a few moments. Then he said, very quietly indeed, open the door, my darling. I can't, said I. The key is down by the front door under a plantain leaf. And then I said it again, several times, very gently and slowly, and said it so often that he had to go and see. And he got it, of course, and came in. He stopped short by the door. What is the matter? He cried. For God's sake, what are you doing? I just kept on creeping just the same, but I looked at him over my shoulder. I've got out at last, said I, in spite of you and Jane, and I've pulled off most of the paper, so you can't put me back. Now why should that man have fainted? But he did, and right across my path by the wall, so that I had to creep over him every time.
Virginia Woolf, one of the great writers of the modern period, suffered from what would probably be diagnosed today as bipolar disorder. In Mrs. Dalloway, she is exploring life post-World War I. And you have to understand that the Great War was something that the experience was incredibly traumatic. It introduced modern weaponry and trench warfare, and so many writers at the time explored the impact that had on people. In the novel, Woolf creates a character, Septimus Warren Smith, a veteran of the war who eventually kills himself. He suffers from shell shock, which is what we would call post-traumatic stress disorder today. In this scene, just before Septimus jumps out the window, he interacts with his wife, Rezia. There's a sense of Septimus feeling trapped by his doctor, whose name is Holmes, and trapped by his treatment. There's a sense of his not wanting someone to have power over him in this world. The excerpt's going to be read by Chris Swinford.
Bipolar disorder is a mental illness characterized by widely fluctuating mood states. The individual may experience an abnormally elevated or irritable mood, known as mania, followed by periods of extreme depression. During the mania episode, the individual may have grandiose ideas, sleep less, be more talkative than usual, experience racing thoughts, or show poor judgment. For instance, going on shopping sprees, committing sexual indiscretions, or making foolish business investments. Bipolar disorder affects approximately 5.7 million adult Americans every year, according to the National Institute of Mental Health. PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder, can develop when a person has witnessed or experienced an event which posed threat of serious injury or death to self or others. Their experience involved intense fear, helplessness, or horror, and the traumatic event is re-experienced through frequent recollections. They may have nightmares or experience flashbacks or hallucinations. The individual persistently avoids thoughts, feelings, activities, places, people, or conversations associated with the trauma. Other characteristics of the disorder include a reduced interest in life activities, feelings of detachment from others, limited emotional range, or a sense the individual won't have a career or marriage, etc. They may have trouble sleeping, be irritable or have outbursts of anger, have difficulty concentrating, be hypervigilant, or be easily startled. The National Center for PTSD states that seven or eight out of every 100 people will have PTSD at some point in their lives. Women are more likely than men to develop PTSD. Furthermore, experts think PTSD occurs in about 11 to 20% of veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, 10% of the Gulf War veterans, and about 30 out of 100 Vietnam veterans.
Rezia, sitting at the table, twisting a hat in her hands, watched him, saw him smiling. He was happy then, but she could not bear to see him smiling. It was not marriage. It was not being one's husband to look strange like that, always to be starting, laughing, sitting hour after hour silent, or clutching her and telling her to write. The table drawer was full of those writings, about war, about Shakespeare, about great discoveries, how there is no death. Lately, he had become excited suddenly, for no reason, and waved his hands and cried out that he knew the truth. He knew everything. That man, his friend who was killed, Evans, had come, he said. He was singing behind the screen. She wrote it down just as he spoke it. Some things were very beautiful, others sheer nonsense. And he was always stopping in the middle, changing his mind, wanting to add something, hearing something new, listening with his hand up. But she heard nothing. And once they found the girl who did the room reading one of these papers in fits of laughter, it was a dreadful pity, for that made Septimus cry out about human cruelty. How they tear each other to pieces, the fallen, he said, they tear to pieces. Holmes is on us, he would say, and he would invent stories about Holmes. Holmes eating porridge, Holmes reading Shakespeare, making himself roar with laughter or rage. for Dr. Holmes seemed to stand for something horrible to him. Human nature, he called him. Then there were the visions. He was drowned, he used to say, and lying on a cliff with the gull screaming over him. He would look over the edge of the sofa, down into the sea. Or he was hearing music. Really, it was only a barrel organ, or some man crying in the street. But, lovely, he used to cry, and the tears would run down his cheeks, which was to her the most dreadful thing of all. To see a man like Septimus, who had fought, who was brave, crying. And he would lie, listening, until suddenly he would cry that he was falling down into the flames. Actually, she would look for flames, it was so vivid, but there was nothing. They were alone in the room. It was a dream, she would tell him, and so quiet him at last. But sometimes she was frightened too. She sighed as she sat sewing.
Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings, in a lot of ways, is about the same war, the Great War, in which Tolkien himself fought. In the books, after the battles are done, remember, Frodo returns home, shell-shocked, kind of like Septimus. But the character Gollum presents another kind of mental illness, perhaps, dissociative identity disorder. We like sharing this excerpt, which is a scene where there seem to be two personalities arguing with each other. But keep in mind that this particular idea of mental illness, of a character switching between a, quote, good and a, quote, evil self, kind of like Jekyll and Hyde, is another example of a sort of stereotype, one that can contribute to stigma around the condition or mental illness in general. The excerpt is going to be read by Madeline Panuta.
Dissociative identity disorder, also known as multiple personality disorder, is a controversial and rarely diagnosed disorder. Thought to be the effect of extreme repetitive physical, sexual, or emotional abuse during early childhood, it is characterized by the presence of two or more distinct identities which take control of the individual's behavior. The individual also experiences an inability to recall important personal information. Statistics show that the rate of dissociative identity disorder is 0.01% to 1% of the general population. But a 2006 study published by the American Journal of Psychiatry reported that dissociative identity disorder was diagnosed in 5 of 82 inner-city mental hospital patients, a rate of 6%. Dissociative identity disorder has been successfully treated with hypnosis.
The day passed slowly, a great thirst troubling them, but they drank only a few drops from their bottles, last filled in the gully, which now, as they look back in thought, seemed to them a place of peace and beauty. The hobbits took in a turn to watch. At first, tired as they were, neither of them could sleep at all, but as the sun far away was climbing down into slow-moving clouds, Sam dozed. It was Frodo's turn to be on guard. He laid back on the slope of the pit, but that did not ease the senses of burden that was on him. He looked up at the smoke-streaked sky and saw strange phantoms, dark writing shapes, and faces out of the past. He lost count of time hovering between sleep and waking, until forgetfulness came over him. Suddenly, Sam woke up, thinking that he heard his master calling. It was evening. Frodo could not have called, for he had fallen asleep and slid down nearly to the bottom of the pit. Gollum was by him. For a moment, Sam thought he was trying to rouse Frodo. Then he saw that it was not so. Gollum was talking to himself. Smeagol was holding a debate with some other thought that used to use the same voice, but made it squeak and hiss. A pale light and a green light alternated in his eyes as he spoke. Smeagol promised, he said, the first thought. Yes, yes, my precious, came the answer. We promised to save our precious, not to let him have it, never. But it's going to him, yes? Nearer every step, What's the Hobbit going to do with it? We wonders, yes, we wonders. I don't know. I can't help it. Master's got it. Smeagol promised to help the Master. Yes, yes, to the Master of the Precious. But if we was Master, then we could help ourselves, yes, and still keep promises. But Smeagol said he would be very, very good. Nice Hobbit. He took cruel rope off Smeagol's leg. He speaks nicely to me. Very, very good, eh, my precious? Let's be good, good as fish, sweet one, but to ourselves. Not hurt the nice Hobbit, of course, no, no. But the precious holds the promise, the voice of Smeagol objected. Then take it, said the other, and let's hold it ourselves, then we shall be the master. Gollum, make the other Hobbit, the nasty, suspicious Hobbit, make him crawl, yes, Gollum? But not the nice Hobbit. Oh, no, not if it doesn't please us. Still, he's a Baggins. Yes, my precious, yes, a Baggins. A Baggins stole it, he found it, and he said nothing, nothing. We hate Bagginsies. No, not this Baggins. Yes, every Baggins. All peoples that keep the precious. We must have it. But he'll see, he'll know, he'll take it from us. He sees, he knows. He heard us make silly promises against his orders, yes? Make, must take it. The wraiths are searching, must take it. Not for him. No, sweet one. See, my precious, if we has it, then we can escape. Even from him. Perhaps we grow very strong, stronger than wraiths. Lord Smeagol, Gollum the Great, the Gollum. Eat fish every day, three times a day. Fresh ones from the sea. Most precious Gollum. Must have it. We wants it. We wants it. We wants it. But there's two of them. They'll wake too quick and kill us, whined Smeagol in the last effort. Not now. Not yet. We wants it, but... And here there was a long pause, as if a new thought had weakened. Not yet, eh? Perhaps not. She might help. She might, yes. No, no. That way, wailed Smeagol. Yes, we wants it. We wants it. Each time the second thought spoke, Gollum's long hand crept out slowly, pawing towards Frodo, then was drawn back with a jerk as Smeagol spoke. Finally, both arms, with long fingers, flexed and twitched, clawed towards his neck. Sam had lain still, fantasized by this debate, but watching every move that Gollum made from under his half-closed eyelids to his simple mind, ordinary and hungry, the desire to eat hobbits had seemed to the chief danger in Gollum. He realized now that it was not so. Gollum was feeling the terrible call of the ring. The Dark Lord was he, of course, but Sam wondered who she was. One of the nasty friends the little wretch had made in the wandering, he supposed. Then forget the point, for things had plainly gone far enough and were getting dangerous. A great heaviness was in all his limbs, and he rose himself with an effort and sat up. Something warned him to be careful and not to reveal that he had overheard the debate. He let out a loud sigh and gave a huge yawn. "What's the time?" he said sleepily. Gollum sent out a long hiss through his teeth. He stood up for a moment, tensed and menacing, and then he collapsed, falling forward on all fours and crawling up the banks of the pit. "Nice hobbits, nice Sam," he said. "Sleepyheads, yes, sleepyheads. Leave good Gollum to watch. But it's evening. Dusk is creeping. Time to go."
Written by Daniel Keyes, Flowers for Algernon, which is published in 1959, is a well-known science fiction novel about a man, Charlie Gordon, who is developmentally disabled, but who undergoes a surgical procedure that essentially turns him into a genius. The book explores a number of questions, from the use of surgery to correct mental illness, to our stance on any push to normalize, quote-unquote, individuals in society. The novel is written as a series of Charlie's journal entries. The entry you're going to hear today takes place shortly after the surgery, and the excerpt will be read by Nicole Feltz.
November 21st. I did a dumb thing today. I forgot I wasn't in Miss Kinnean's class at the adult center anymore like I used to be. I went in and sat down in my old seat in the back of the room, and she looked at me funny. And she said, "Charlie, where have you been?" So I said, "Hello, Miss Kinnean. I'm ready for my lesson today, only I lost the book we were using." She started to cry and ran out of the room, and everybody looked at me, and I saw a lot of them wasn't the same people who used to be in my class. Then all of a sudden, I remembered some things about the operation and me getting smart, and I said, "Holy smoke, I really pulled a Charlie Gordon that time." I went away before she came back to the room. That's why I'm going away from here for good, to the Warren Homeschool. I don't want to do nothing like that again. I don't want Miss Kinnean to feel sorry for me. I know everybody feels sorry for me at the bakery, and I don't want that either. So I'm going someplace where there are a lot of people like me, and nobody cares that Charlie Gordon was once a genius, and now he can't even read a book or write good. I'm taking a couple of books along with me, and even if I can't read them, I'll practice hard, and maybe I'll even get a little bit smarter than I was before the operation, without an operation. I got a new rabbit's foot and a lucky penny, and even a little bit of magic powder left, and maybe they will help me. If you ever read this, Miss Kinnean, don't be sorry for me. I'm glad I got a second chance in life, like you said, to be smart, because I learned a lot of things that I never even knew were in this world, and I'm grateful I saw it all, even for a little bit. And I'm glad I found out all about my family and me. It was like I never had a family till I remembered about them and saw them. And now I know I had a family and I was a person just like everyone.
Sylvia Plath was the first person to win a posthumous Pulitzer Prize for the collected poems. During her lifetime, she suffered from extreme depression and spent some time in a mental hospital. The poem you're going to hear, Lady Lazarus, is one of her most well-known. It invokes imagery of Hitler's Germany as it explores Plath's several suicide attempts. Critic Arthur Oberg describes how, quote, "The movement in the poem is at once historical and private. The confusion in these two spheres suggests the extent to which the last century has often made it impossible to separate them." The poem's going to be read by Aileen Rohan.
I've already told you a little bit about depression. Now I just want to say a few words about suicide. The World Health Organization estimates that approximately 1 million people die each year from suicide. Suicide is a desperate attempt to escape suffering that has become unbearable. Blinded by feelings of self-loathing, hopelessness, and isolation, a suicidal person can't see any way of finding relief except through death. Warning signs include talking about suicide, seeking out lethal means, preoccupation with death, no hope for the future, saying goodbye to people, risky behaviors, and a sudden sense of calm.
I have done it again. 1 year in every 10, I manage it. A sort of walking miracle. My skin, bright as a Nazi lampshade. My right foot, a paperweight. My face, a featureless fine Jew linen. Peel off the skin, oh, my enemy. Do I terrify? The nose, the eye pits, the full set of teeth. The sour breath will vanish in a day. Soon, soon the flesh, the grave cave ate, will be at home on me, and I, a smiling woman. I am only 30, and like the cat, I have 9 times to die. This is number 3. What a trash to annihilate each decade. What a million filaments the peanut-crunching crowd shoves in to see. Them unwrap me hand and foot, the big striptease. Ladies and gentlemen, these are my hands, my knees. I might be skin and bone, nevertheless, I am the same identical woman. The first time it happened, I was 10. It was an accident. The second time, I meant to last it out and not come back at all. I rocked shut as a seashell. They had to call and call and pick the worms off me like sticky pearls. Dying is an art like everything else. I do it exceptionally well. I do it so it feels like hell. I do it so it feels real. I guess you could say I have a call. It's easy enough to do it in a cell. It's easy enough to do it and stay put. It's a theatrical comeback in broad day, to the same place, the same face, the same brute, amused shout, a miracle that knocks me out. There's a charge for the eyeing of my scars. There's a charge for the hearing of my heart. It really goes. And there's a charge, a very large charge, for a word or a touch or a bit of blood or a piece of my hair or my clothes. So air, doctor. So air, enemy. I am your opus. I am your valuable, the pure gold baby that melts to a shriek. I turn and burn. I do not think I underestimate your great concern. Ash, ash, you poke and stir. Flesh, bone, there's nothing there. A cake of soap, a wedding ring, a gold filling. Air God, air Lucifer, beware, beware. Out of the ash I rise with my red hair, and I eat men like air.
The book Civil was written in 1973. It's a nonfiction work that in the last couple of years has been shown to be fraudulent. It's the story of a woman with what was then labeled a multiple personality disorder. She was reported to have 16 different personalities. The book's another example of the power of the media to sort of shape our sense of these attitudes and so on. After the book came out, multiple personality disorder became an official disorder, and by the mid-90s, there were 40,000 reported cases. However, multiple personality disorder is considered by some to be a culture-bound syndrome, a culturally permitted expression of extreme stress. The author of the book who exposes the fraud, Debbie Nathan, suggested, quote, "The Sybil craze erupted during a fractured moment in history when women pushed to go forward even as the culture pulled back in fear." In the excerpt you're going to hear, Sybil's therapist, Dr. Wilbur, finally meets one of her patient's other personalities. And the excerpt's going to be read by Dana Mack.
Sybil seemed calm that morning and talked of Stan's letter with her customary lack of emotion, but when she opened her purse, she became suddenly flustered. She saw that only half of the letter was there, a half with a zigzag edge. She hadn't torn it. Who had? She ransacked her purse in search of the missing half. It was not there. She shuffled the other two letters she had received that morning in her lap. They were intact, exactly where she remembered having put them. But she also remembered having put Stan's letter. It had been whole then, with them. Now the missing half of his letter was not even to be found. Who had removed it? When? Where had she been when it had happened? She had no memory of the moment. It had happened again. This terrible thing that happened to time. It had followed her here, to the haven of the doctor's office, this black shadow that followed her everywhere. Gingerly, stealthily, in an effort to conceal what had happened from the doctor, who was sitting away from her, on the chair at the head of the couch, Sybil slipped the mutilated letter behind the other two. But the doctor was asking, "Do you want me to see the letter?" Sybil started to stammer, and the stammer dissolved into something else. The prim, gentle Midwestern schoolteacher, her face contorted with fear and fury, jumped up from the desk chair and, moving so fast that she seemed to do everything at once, ripped up the letters that had been in her lap and threw their remains in the wastebasket. Then, clenching her fist, she stood in the middle of the room, ranting, "Men are all alike. You just can't trust them. You really can't." She headed with rapid, spider-like movements toward two long casement windows. Swinging the green draperies aside, she clenched her left fist again and pounded with it at a small window pane. "Let me out," she screamed. "Let me out." It was an agonized plea, the call of the haunted, the trapped. Dr. Wilbur moved swiftly, but not swiftly enough. Before she could reach her patient, there was a crash. The pounding fist had gone through the window pane. "Let me see your hand," the doctor insisted as she grasped the wrist. Her patient shrank from her touch. "I only want to see if you cut yourself," the doctor explained gently. This time the patient stood absolutely still, her eyes wide with wonder as she looked at Dr. Wilbur for the first time since jumping up from the chair. In a plaintive little girl voice, a voice quite different from the one that had denounced men, the patient asked, "You're not mad about the window?" "Of course not," the doctor replied. I'm more important than the window? The tone was one of curious disbelief. Of course you are, the doctor remarked reassuringly. Anybody can fix a window pane. I'll call the handyman. He'll do it. Suddenly the patient seemed more relaxed. This time, when the doctor took her hand, she offered no resistance. Come, let's sit on the couch. The doctor suggested, I want to have a good look at your hand. Let me see if it's bruised. They turned away from the window and walked toward the couch, past the purse, which had fallen out on the rug when the patient had jumped up, past assorted papers, drawing pencils, the outpourings of fury that had belched from the fallen purse. But now the fear and fury were gone. Sybil had always maintained a safe distance from the doctor by sitting at the desk. This time, however, Sybil sat right up beside the doctor and let her hand linger in the doctor's, even after the latter had declared, no cut, no bruise. But once again there was a shift of mood. There's blood, the patient said. No blood, replied the doctor. You didn't cut yourself. Blood in the hayloft, the patient explained. Tommy Ewald was killed. I was there. You were there? The doctor echoed. Yes, I was there. I was, too. Where was the hayloft? In Willow Corners. Did you live in Willow Corners? I live there, came the correction. Just everybody knows I live in Willow Corners. Just. Sybil didn't talk that way. But then, the Sybil the doctor knew didn't do any of the things that had been done since the patient jumped up from the chair. Gradually, as Sybil continued to relive what had transpired in the hayloft, the doctor was overtaken by an uncanny, eerie feeling. Since the patient had jumped up from the chair, the feeling had been there, muted yet insistent, like the traffic noises that trickled into the room through the broken window pane. The more Sybil talked, the more insistent the feeling became. My friend Rachel was sitting with me in the hayloft, Sybil was saying, and some other children. Tommy said, let's jump down into the barn. We jumped. One of the kids hit the cash register. There was a gun there. The gun went off. I went back, and Tommy was lying there dead, a bullet through his heart. The other children ran away, not Rachel and me. She went for Dr. Quinones. I stayed with Tommy. Dr. Quinones came and told us to go home. We didn't go. We helped him remove the gun and put a blanket over Tommy. Tommy was only 10 years old. You are two brave little girls, Dr. Wilbur said. I know Tommy's dead, the childlike voice continued. I understand, I do. I stayed because I didn't think it right to leave Tommy lying there dead. Tell me, the doctor asked. Where are you now? There's blood, was the reply. I see blood. Blood and death. I know what death is. I do. Don't think about the blood, the doctor said. It makes you sad. You care how I feel? Again, there was a look of curious disbelief. I care very much, the doctor replied. You're not just trying to trick me? Why should I? Lots of people trick me. The sense of being tricked, the anger, the terror, the feeling of entrapment, the profound distrust of people, the wistful, plaintive conviction that a window, a thing, was more important than she. These feelings and attitudes, expressed in the course of this hour, were symptoms of some profound disturbance, and all had turned up in the tortured mind of the patient like a dark deposit in a turbid well. From the moment the patient had dashed to the window, the doctor had been aware not only that her behavior was uncharacteristic, but also that she actually looked and sounded different. She seemed smaller, shrunken. Sybil always stood as tall as she could, because she considered herself small and didn't want to appear so. But now she seemed to have shrunk into herself. The voice was also quite different, childlike, not like Sybil's voice. Yet that little girl voice had uttered a woman's words in its denunciation of men. Men are all alike. You just can't trust them. And the word just? Sybil, perfectionist schoolteacher, strict grammarian, would never use a substandard word such as just. The doctor had the distinct impression that she was dealing with someone younger than Sybil. But the denunciation of men? The doctor couldn't be sure. Then the thought she had reined back broke forth. Who are you? Can't you tell the difference? Was the reply, accompanied by a resolutely independent tossing of the head. I'm Peggy. The doctor didn't answer, and Peggy continued. We don't look alike. You can see that. You can. When the doctor asked for her last name, Peggy replied airily, I use Dorset and sometimes Baldwin. I'm really Peggy Baldwin. Tell me something about yourself, the doctor suggested. All right, Peggy acquiesced. Do you want to hear about my painting? I like to paint in black and white. I do charcoal and pencil sketches. I don't paint as much or as well as Sybil. The doctor waited a moment, then she proceeded. And who is Sybil? The doctor waited, and Peggy replied, Sybil? Why, she's the other girl.
Susanna Kaysen's 1993 account of her two-year stint in a psychiatric hospital in the 60s charts the changes in such healthcare facilities at that time. Diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, the book explores the fine line between, as the New York Times puts it, those society deems mad and those it deems sane. It also tells us, the Times continues, that those who have crossed that line can never really come all the way back. In the excerpt, we get a glimpse into Susanna's life at the facility, and the excerpt is read by Jacob Boglio.
Borderline personality disorder individuals suffering from borderline personality disorder frantically attempt to avoid real or imagined abandonment by significant others. Relationships are unstable and intense. Their sense of self is unstable, and they may demonstrate impulsive behavior that is self-damaging. They may engage in self-injury behaviors, experience chronic feelings of emptiness, demonstrate emotional instability, and exhibit inappropriate anger. They may also experience paranoia, and many individuals have frequent thoughts of suicide. Borderline personality disorder can be successfully treated using dialectical behavior therapy.
People ask, "How did you get in there?" What they really want to know is if they are likely to end up in there as well. I can't answer the real question. All I can tell them is, it's easy. And it is easy to slip into a parallel universe. There are so many of them. Worlds of the insane, the criminal, the crippled, the dying, perhaps of the dead as well. These worlds exist alongside this world and resemble it, but are not in it. My roommate Georgina came in swiftly and totally during her junior year at Vassar. She was in theater watching a movie when a tidal wave of blackness broke over her head. The entire world was obliterated for a few minutes. She knew she had gone crazy. She looked around the theater to see if it had happened to everyone, but all the other people were engrossed in the movie. She rushed out because the darkness in the theater was too much when combined with the darkness in her head. And after that, I asked her, a lot of darkness, she said. But most people pass over incrementally, making a series of perforations in the membrane between here and there until an opening exits. And who can resist an opening? In the parallel universe, the laws of physics are suspended. What goes up does not necessarily come down. A body at rest does not tend to stay at rest, and not every action can be counted on to provoke an equal and opposite reaction. Time, too, is different. It may run in circles, flow backwards, molecules are fluid. Tables can be clocks, faces, flowers. These are facts you find out later, though. Another odd feature of a parallel universe is that although it is invisible from this side, once you are in it, you can easily see the world you came from. Sometimes the world you came from looks huge and menacing, quivering like a vast pile of jelly. At other times, it is miniaturized and alluring, a spin and shining in its orbit. Either way, it can be discounted. Every window on Alcatraz has a view of San Francisco.
Chuck Palahniuk's 1996 novel Fight Club explores gender dynamics and masculinity in American culture. The unnamed narrator also provides yet another example of a character with dissociative identity disorder. In this excerpt, we see the narrator finally aware that Tyler Durden, the violent, antisocial, tough man the narrator aspires to be like, is in fact an alternate personality he himself has created. The excerpt's going to be read by Warren Higginbotham.
The first time I met Tyler was when I was asleep. I was tired and crazy and rushed. And every time I boarded an airplane, I wanted the plane to crash. I envied people dying of cancer. I hated my life. I was tired and I was bored with my job and my furniture. And I couldn't see any way to change things, only to end them. I felt trapped. I was too complete. I was too perfect. I wanted a way out my life, single serving butter and cramped airline seat in the world. Swedish furniture, clever art. I took a vacation. I fell asleep on the beach, and when I woke up there was Tyler, naked and sweating, gritty with sand and his stringy hair. Tyler was pulling driftwood logs out of the surf and dragging them up the beach. What Tyler had created was the shadow of a giant hand, and Tyler was sitting in the palm of perfection he made for himself. And a moment was the most you could ever expect from a perfection. Maybe I never really woke up on that beach. Maybe all this started when I peed on a Barney stone. When I fell asleep, I didn't really fall asleep. At other tables in the Planet Denny's, I count 1, 2, 3, 5 guys with black cheekbones or folded down noses smiling at me. "No," Marla says. "You don't sleep?" Tyler Durden is a separate personality I've created, and now he's starting to take over my real life. "Just like Tony Perkins' mother is psycho," Marla says. "This is so cool. Everyone has their little quirks. One time, I dated a guy who couldn't get enough body piercings." My point being, I say I fall asleep and Tyler is running off with my body and punched out face to commit some crime. The next morning, I wake up bone tired and beat up. I'm sure I haven't slept at all. The next night, I go to bed earlier. That next night, Tyler will be in charge a little longer. Every night that I go to bed earlier and earlier, Tyler will be in charge longer and longer. "But you are Tyler," Marla says. No, I'm not. I love everything about Tyler Durden. His courage and his smarts, his nerve. Tyler is funny and charming and forceful and independent, and men look up to him and expect him to change their world. Tyler is capable of free, and I'm not. I'm not Tyler Durden. "But you are," Marla says.
Our last text comes from We Need to Talk About Kevin, which is a novel by Lionel Shriver written in 2003. The book is about the mother of a sociopath, and it follows Eva Kachadourian and her son Kevin's relationship, which is always strained. The bond that is normally formed between a parent and child doesn't seem to happen. As a teen, Eva's son plans and executes a school massacre. In the excerpt, we're going to see Eva visit Kevin in prison, and it's going to be read by Tanya Schmitz.
Antipersonality disorder is another name for sociopath. While people with antisocial personality disorder can be witty and charming when they choose, their life is dominated by patterns of disregard for and violation of the rights of others. They fail to conform to social norms or lawful behaviors and may be deceitful, repeatedly lying, using aliases, or conning others for personal profit or leisure. They are impulsive and may not plan ahead. They demonstrate irritability and aggressiveness, often being involved in physical fights, and have a reckless disregard for the safety of self or others. Other symptoms include consistent failure to sustain work behavior or honor financial obligations. They show a lack of remorse, being indifferent to hurting, mistreating, or stealing from another. As reported by the National Institute of Mental Health, a 2007 study identified 1 in 100 people experienced antisocial personality disorder in the U.S. in a 12-month period. Men are more likely to be diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder than women. Individuals with this disorder rarely seek treatment on their own.
Claverack's experimental policy of allowing inmates to wear street clothes has allowed Kevin to reiterate his fashion statement inside. While New York's corner boys flapping in outsized gear look like toddlers from a distance, Kevin's shrunken mode of dress has the opposite effect of making him look bigger, more adult, bursting. One of his psych consultants has accused me of finding the style unnerving for his aggressive sexuality. Kevin's crotch cuts revealingly into his testicles, and the paint-on t-shirt makes his nipples protrude. Perhaps. Certainly the tight sleeves hems, the taut collars, and the yanked-in waistbands strap his body in cords and remind me of bondage. He looks uncomfortable, and in this respect, the garb is apt. Kevin is uncomfortable. The tiny clothing replicates the same constriction that he feels in his own skin. Reading his suffocating attire as equivalent to penicillin hair shirt might seem a stretch, but the waistbands chafe, the collars score his neck. Discomfort begets discomfort in others, of course, and that too might be part of the plan. I often find that when I'm with him, I pull my own clothes, discreetly pricing a seam from between my buttocks or releasing an extra button on my blouse. Eyeing laconic interchanges at adjoining tables, I've detected that some of his fellow inmates have started to mimic Kevin's eccentric dress sense. I gather that t-shirts and unusually small sizes have become prized possessions, and Kevin himself has mentioned smugly that runts are being robbed of their clothes. He may hold imitators up to ridicule, but he does seem gratified at having initiated his very own fad. Were he commensurately concerned with originality 2 years ago, the seven students he used for target practice will be preparing for applications to the colleges of the choice by now. Anyway, today, he lounged into the visiting room wearing what must have been one of the runts' sweatpants, since I didn't recognize them as the ones I bought. The little plaid button-down he wore on top was only secured by the middle two buttons, exposing his midriff. Now even his tennis shoes were too small, and he crushes his heels under his feet. He may not like to hear me say it, but he's graceful. There's a languor in his motions as to the way he talks. And he's always that skew, too. He walks sideways like a crab, leading with his left hip, gives him the subtle sidle of a supermodel on a catwalk. If he realized I saw traces of femininity in him, I doubt he'd be offended. He prizes ambiguity. He loves to keep you guessing. What a surprise, he said smoothly, pulling out the chair. His back legs had lost their plastic feet and the raw aluminum street across the cement, a fingernail on the blackboard sound that Kevin drew out. He slid his elbow across the table, resting his temple on his fist, assuming that characteristic tilt, sardonic with his whole body. I try to stop myself, but whenever he sits in front of me, I rear back. I do get irked, and I'm always the one who has to come up with something to talk about. He's old enough to carry on a conversation, and since he has imprisoned me in my life every bit as much as he's imprisoned himself in his, we suffer an equal poverty of fresh subject matter. Often we run through the same script. How are you? I ask with brutal simplicity. You want me to say I'm fine? I want you to say something, I throw back. You're the one who came to see me, he reminds me, and he can't and will sit it out the whole hour. As for which of us has the greater tolerance of nullity, there's no contest. He used to spend whole Saturdays propped theatrically in front of the Weather Channel. So today I skipped even a perfunctory house tricks on the theory that folks who shun small talk are still dependent on its easing transitions, but have learned to make other people do all the work. And I was still agitated by my exchange with Loretta Greenleaf. Maybe having tempted his own mother into boasting about her connection in this filthy atrocity would afford him some satisfaction. But apparently my messianic impulse has taken responsibility for Thursday onto myself, reads to Kevin as a form of stealing. All right, I said, no nonsense. I need to know. Do you blame me? It's all right to say so. Is that what you think? Is that what you tell your psych consults, or they tell you? It all traces back to your mother. He snapped. Why should you get all the credit?
We hope you enjoyed the reading today. Can we just have a quick round of applause for the COM 107 students for doing the great reading? And if you have any questions, please stick around. I know we're right at the end of our usual class time.
Thank you all for your presence. And if you have any further questions about any of these illnesses, feel free to visit us in the Counseling Center.
Thanks for listening to this Moraine Valley Community College Library event podcast. For more information, visit www.morainevalley.edu/library.